On this week's episode of Talos Takes, we bring you a special extra large sized episode. This is the full audio recording of the CTIR on air stream from a few weeks ago. We hope you all enjoy, and we'll see you after Hacker Summer Camp.
Hello, and welcome to Cisco Talos Incident Response CTIR on air. I am your host, Liz Waddell, and this week I am joined with some fearless analysts and consultants and researchers from our field. Let's go around the room and have everybody introduce themselves. Start with Nate.
Hello, everyone. Glad to be here today. Glad to see you here. I'm an incident commander with Cisco Talos Incident Response. That means my role is to lead teams through our flagship product, which is Incident Response.
Very cool. And what's on your mind?
What is on my mind, actually, is doesn't directly impact me because I'm here in the U.S., but I'm sad for all of my friends and colleagues in the U.K. because McDonald's has just, for the first time in years and years, increased the price of the cheeseburger. So if inflation hasn't hit you before, it might now.
Now you feel it. Now you really feel it when you, exactly. You want that. That burger in the UK, which is a good note.
You could almost say that McDonald's is my cultural food, so it really hits me hard.
It does. You mean just like when Taco Bell took away the Mexican pizza 2 weeks ago, still crying. But I am going to the UK in tomorrow. So I'm going tomorrow. So I will know not to go to McDonald's. But you know, hey, the dollar is doing pretty good compared to the pound. So I'm happy about that. All right, let's go next and meet Brett. Hey, Brett.
Hey there. So I've been an incident consultant with Talos since 2018. I come from a background at the Security Operations Center environments. And more recently, my big thing has been developing and updating the cyber range, coming up with new ways of teaching and how we deliver it, improving it, and then getting everyone up to speed on how to go through as an instructor. And what's on my mind? Well, I have a 6-month-old golden retriever, and I am thoroughly convinced that golden retrievers are the best dogs ever, and I need to adopt a second one now.
I can vouch that your golden retriever does receive the bestest girl award ever. She is the most patient dog I have ever seen. Like, I've seen Brett has put goggles on her, and she's just like, hey, I'm in goggles now. This is great. He made her a lion last week, and she was just roaring around, and she loved being a lion. It was so cool.
And wore a hoodie.
And wore a hoodie. Like, yeah, bestest girl ever. But we'll touch back in with Brett later on in this episode about Cyber Rave. So stay tuned. That's going to be some very interesting conversations. Next up, let's go to Bruce. Hey, Bruce, what do you do at Talos?
Good morning, Liz, and everyone else. My name's Bruce. I'm a threat researcher, I guess. Yeah, we'll call myself that, whatever my little tag says below my name. I'm a threat researcher for Cisco Talos, threat intelligence and interdiction. My job basically is to piss off the bad guys, whether that be through interdiction or through any other number of things that we do, just to kind of disrupt things and make them think harder about what they do. So.
Yep, we always love pissing off the bad guys. What's on your mind today?
Well, not a whole lot, considering normally I'd be waking up about 5 minutes ago. So I'm kind of hungry. Beyond that, not a whole lot. Just kind of interested in what kind of ridiculousness we're going to see today.
Well, we can definitely, hopefully, promise ridiculousness. So today what we're doing is we are reviewing our quarterly trends. If you want to follow along, you're welcome to go look at the blog on talosintelligence.com. And all of what we CTIR saw last quarter is recapped on there. And there's also a blog post by Nate that dives into some Quackbot stuff that we're going to talk about in a bit. So encourage you, go to the website, take a look. We'll have some visual aids here, but not a ton, because you should be focusing on us, listening to us. All right. So we're going to start off with our top threat. And, you know, for years, it's just been ransomware. And I did tweet out that I was going to give the answer to this joke. All right. So what happened when there was malware inside the kitten picture? It was catastrophic. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And that is goes along with our top threat for this quarter was actually commodity malware. So Bruce being, you know, our threat, our main threat researcher, although everyone here is well aware of the threats we've been dealing with. But I want to just pick your brain. So why is it that we saw malware come out ahead this quarter?
Well, that's right, Liz. Thanks for the throw off there, the send off, whatever you want to call it. You'd be correct in saying that commodity malware was indeed the top threat this quarter. Now, it turns out that that's because most of the time, well, a lot of the time, even though we're two quarters into 2022 and, what, 20 years into cybersecurity, people are still clicking on that phish email, even today. Really what it boils down to is this year has been kind of weird just because we've had the whole war, you know, in the Ukraine. A lot of the ransomware groups, what we saw, actually focused their efforts on attacking the Ukrainian government and forcing a lot of stuff there. Plus, a lot of the ransomware groups actually had some some shakeups due to police intervention or task force across the world. And so those larger groups like Conti and whatnot broke up into smaller groups. And those groups have been kind of active, but you know, given anything like that, there usually is some ramp down time from what they previously did, and then some ramp up time as they kind of reallocate the resources and get going again through their struggle. So
you know, we've been seeing, like as you said, we've been seeing some people ramp down. We've also been seeing some, and what I will quote, I think Caitlin wrote this, an amalgamation of ransomware. Amalgamation, which is like just a fantastic word. Amalgamation. Sorry, I'm done saying it. And so, but they're like a bunch of like new smaller players that we've seen pop up. Anything that they're doing that's new and interesting, or is it just same old, same old?
Well, that's kind of the thing with ransomware. And when it turns into commodity malware, which we saw with things like Ryuk, right, originally, and that kind of tapered off into some other things, is that they try to keep everything that they deliver kind of the same and easy to use for everyone so they can sell the access, they can sell the use to different groups and do whatever they want to do. What really changes, honestly, is their initial vector. Sometimes, right? Like I mentioned earlier, we still have the phishing aspect that it comes in. But a lot of times people, the ransomware groups, will change how they initially get in and do things. And usually that's based on 0 days that pop up that people just don't know about, right? So you'll get last year and into the beginning of this year, it was a lot of RDP, Citrix exploitation, people having their remote, whatever they choose to use for remote access open to the public, which is still a problem, people. So check your stuff. But, you know, that was the big thing. And then we get into things like Log4j and all these weird things that people just spend their time looking at because they get paid lots of money to do that. And then exploit those things and get in. So those are the more sophisticated things that groups use. But when it becomes commodity malware, a lot of times what we see is it's the easy stuff like the phishing or the reused things that people keep that we keep running into. It's almost like a cyclical nature where some things that were big a few years ago become big again because people don't fix it. And then the bad guys just kind of don't exploit it for a little bit and then come back and do it again. So it's a mix of things. But honestly, right now, there's nothing really out there that people are super taking advantage of that's different and new, I guess, which is kind of boring on our side. But, you know, what can you do?
I mean, this would be a great time for an organization to do all the things that we tell them to do. So, yeah, you know, follow those recommendations. So, you know, let's talk about, you know, before we move off of the subject of ransomware and what we've seen, we're going to say hopefully goodbye to Conti, who did have a shutdown earlier this year. But before they left or went away, wherever happened to Conti, we did get, you know, some last hurrahs with them. Nate, I know you worked on some of our engagements with Conti. Do you want to talk about some of the things we saw there?
Sure do. Yeah, Conti's an old friend. Not sorry to see it go, but sorry to see it go. You know, we'll see it again under a new branding shortly, I'm sure. But regardless, first of all, just talking about Conti in general, it's fascinating that one of these last incidents we observed is almost just picture perfect, the classic example of how you see ransomware incidents play out. Like, if somebody were unwise enough to ask me to teach a class on ransomware, I would use that incident as an example of how it plays out. In this particular case, we saw their initial access gained using the LogForge vulnerability. Once they gained that foothold, they started searching around using typical network reconnaissance methods. Then they started dropping Cobalt Strike beacons, also using Cobalt Strike to put services in, pivot around. They continued with their enumeration. They installed remote desktop tools. In this case, it's AnyDesk, but you'll see all kinds of others in other instances, SplashTop, what have you. They use escalation for privilege through local administrator accounts. And then finally, they did the ransomware classic, where they moved laterally using the IPC network share, which is something we've just seen over and over again. And then once they have all that access, their beacons in place, all that control they want, they detonate the ransomware. And that's the end game for them, unless they're going to previously exfiltrate data, of course.
So, but it really looking like from what you've said, they had their own playbook that mm-hmm. was pretty much parallel to what most defenders say. Hey, this is how an adversary is going to react through your environment. Like, I'm pretty sure I've made that slide like 17,000 times of this is what happened. And so to me, like, I think one of the takeaways is keep fighting your fight and keep doing, you know, when we talk about, you know, actors are moving laterally through your network and you're using network shares, you know, they do that.
Yeah.
They've been doing that for a while. It's not new.
Yeah, there are classic things you can do to stop this type of thing. You got to first harden your perimeter, look for those vulnerabilities, scan for them, educate your users if it's going to be a phishing or social engineering attack like Bruce was talking about. Then you can't just stop there. You have to start thinking about, well, let's game out what happens once the adversary gains access. How are they going to laterally move? Then you have to consider your credentials. What an adversary can do with any given set of credentials, obviously you want, you know, least privilege and that sort of thing to apply. You know, what software on your systems legitimately would potentially enable an adversary, and how you can stop that from working. And then finally, things like protecting your key data, like backups, file servers, that sort of thing. Just making it as hard as possible for the adversary to achieve what they're trying to achieve on your systems.
Awesome. So speaking of, you know, just credentials and phishing, we also have been, everyone's been so joyous over the return of Quackbot. Thanks, we missed you. Now, I knew people who have left like IR because of Quackbot, just because it just is that much of a pain in the ass. So we did see, like there was one instance where they were just doing some thread jacking. What is thread jacking? Because that sounds like something that happens at a gym or maybe like when I get my eyebrows done. Like, what is that?
Yes, that's a great question. I had a chance to dig into this personally recently. And along the line of Quackbot, they just keep doing these things because it works. Phishing always works, regardless of how well protected you are. But what we started honing in on is a difference between two different types of phishing. We would see, and I'll get into the common one first before I talk about this thread hijacking, so it makes sense. So what we ended up dubbing victim hijacking in our blog post is when what we saw in late 2021, where the adversary would attack an exchange server, take it over, and just use it to launch waves of phishing emails out to the internet. Because it was coming from a legitimate exchange server, it looked legitimate and would get a lot of clicks. So that was very popular for
was period it, was of time. This Hafnium?
It was. Yeah, the Hafnium group was using that proxy logon vulnerability that has since been patched. So what we've been seeing recently, though, in contrast to this victim hijacking, is this thread hijacking. And what the adversary is doing, some of this is a little bit speculative, but it's based on some data points that really give us confidence in it. We saw the adversary coming in with really old emails, like from 2020, 2021, and then replying to those threads. But when we really dug into it, what we ended up concluding is that the adversary harvested a bunch of email threads from, we'll call them third parties, just organizations around the internet. Then they would search and create for emails relevant to the organization they wanted to attack. And then they would use those threads to attack that organization, basically send them waves of phishing emails from outside built on those legitimate threats. So the key takeaway we saw is that without compromising the victim's Exchange server, they were still sending them extremely credible phishing emails that looked like they had originated from that organization's Exchange server. So very confusing and distressing for some of our customers, and we were glad we were able to help them cut through the noise and see that, you know, while this did look serious, and it is serious, of course, any phishing is serious, it didn't mean that their Exchange server had been popped. So the fascinating thing to me is that the adversary is using emails that are over a year old now to still do bad things.
So I think part of that is, you know, some security awareness that if you have an email that, so were they changing the dates to make them not look old, or was it, did it still say 2020 in it when you got the email?
Yeah, they actually weren't making a great effort to make these look super credible. This was, they were scripting it. They were doing this, you know, with the lowest possible imaginable level of effort. They recognized, I think, that you can't really make an extremely believable email chain off of an email from 2021. Any reasonable user would raise their eyebrows at that. So what they did, instead of going for credibility, they went for volume and just sent hundreds and thousands of these emails, hoping for a lucky hit on some user that, you know, was having a bad day and wasn't paying attention.
Someone was not practicing their mindfulness. Be mindful when you read your emails. You know, I think that will bring you some, get some zen when you get into them and really look and then be like, hey, did Phil really talk to me about something from 2 years ago? That didn't make sense at all. All right. So we're running time. We shortened time on our top trends. There's a couple that I just want to hit before we move on to our next segment. One being initial vectors. Obviously, you know, we're still talking about phishing and all those things, but we are still seeing misconfigured public facing applications, et cetera, being exploited by adversaries. So Brett, can you talk to me just real quick about what are some of the risks to having servers exposed to the internet, and what can you do to prevent this?
Well, we came across a number of them more recently. This was dealing with Citrix, and you know, this was internet facing. It was not behind a VPN, and if you have an internet facing login that accepts a username and password, regardless if there's multi-factor authentication or not, you're going to have credentials that exist elsewhere in the internet. So, so-and-so uses the same password. Maybe they append a one or a two at the end, or they, you know, it becomes pretty easy to start guessing. And so if you get a dump from somewhere else, you come to a company, you do some LinkedIn looking around, you find your target, and then you log in as them, and it prompts you for the multi-factor. Well, all you have to do is just keep spamming them with a push notification, and eventually somebody's going to get tired. They're going to say accept. And if you don't have someone monitoring your MFA logs on a almost real-time basis, and you don't have something that's going to escalate up to your security operations center or whoever that's looking at it, that there's been a fraud alert. So you may be a set of throttling. If you get two, I did not send these in 5 minutes or within a day even, then that needs to be looked into. And if you start seeing several of those within a short period of time, then you know someone's trying to brute force and password spray their way into your environment. And if you have a fairly flat network layout, so your Citrix system lets you into a VDI, and something occurs where threat actor is inside, how trivial is it to then just hop servers, start dumping credentials with Mimikatz, whatever you need to download up GitHub, and now you're domain admin.
Woohoo!
So
sounds exciting. Yeah.
Public facing can be pretty risky. Just so if you can put it behind a VPN, limit your access, and even once they do get in, limit your VDIs. Let them, even if they do get in, which is likely, limit the damage they can do. If they're a certain level of user, then they're on their VDI, but they don't have access. They can't RDP. They can't run Bloodhound. They can't map out anything. Limit it as best you can, because eventually the threat actor will get in. It's not a question of if, but when.
Oh, yeah. That sounds a little scary, but it's true. It's true. Okay, so I think it's time for us to move into one of my favorite segments of On Air, and that is the dumpster fire. So during the dumpster fire, what we do is we give one of our team members the chance to let things off their chest, things in the security world that just get their goat. And Nate, I think you have something that's on your mind. Do you want to tell the world what your dumpster fire is?
I sure do. You don't know how long I've been waiting for this opportunity. My rant today is going to be about MFA. Brett was just talking about it, but I am a big fan. For those of you that don't know, that's multi-factor authentication. We harp on this a lot. I'm going to harp on it a little more, so buckle up. It is lack of MFA is one of the most popular entry factors. What almost always when I have an incident involving an adversary getting into an environment through O365 or a web portal or VDI or something, I'll ask, hey, did you have multi-factor authentication enabled? And most of the time the customer will say, no, we were planning on it, but we didn't. Well, too late. The idea is you have to apply MFA, you have to apply it early, and you have to apply it uniformly. If you lock the door with MFA, but leave a window open, the adversary is going to find it. You can't leave individual users exempt from MFA, groups and portals exempt from MFA. You got to apply it everywhere. The adversary can't get in, they will. If your leadership, because this is another common thing I hear, if they complain about the user experience being degraded due to MFA, well, respectfully, I'm about the user impact of ransomware on your organization. Helpful statistic, 31% of organizations in the US that are hit with ransomware end up closing their doors as a result of the financial loss associated with it. So a little user experience hit is to be tolerated. Understand it's difficult communicating that sometimes, but it's just the reality of how this business works. MFA isn't perfect, like Brett was saying, MFA bombing exists and is a thing, but it's a lot better than the alternative, the adversary just getting a username and password and walking in the door. Bottom line is, if you're a customer and still holding off on MFA, please reconsider. We love your business, but we also want to see you succeed. So please, please, please put on MFA on everything. End my rant.
Please, please, please just put on MFA. Why don't you have MFA on? I don't understand. I don't get it. But you're right. It's a good rant. All right. So thank you, Nate, for that. I think we all enjoyed and agree. If you don't agree, find Nate on the internet. Okay. So our next segment, this is lovingly known as Liz's Crystal Ball because I am the InfoSec Mystic and I look into this to predict all the trends that are coming up in the future. And I don't have to look at it very hard. It's ransomware. It's still ransomware. It's going to be ransomware. So what we're seeing and what is happening is rebranding of certain organizations. People will get, efforts will move away from, certain war efforts, and people like making money. Criminals need to make money. So we are going to continue to see more variants of ransomware and probably doing the same things because people don't do what we tell them to. So do what we tell you. Yeah. I guess, I don't know. But anyways, I think it's not going to end. It's never going to end. We're going to keep seeing it. It's going to be different, but it's going to be the same. That's my principle. Everything will be different. Everything will be the same. I think, but that probably goes on what are those called? The samplers? Yeah, someone can cross stitch that. And that is my prediction for the future. Everything changes. Everything stays the same. All right, so now we're moving into another topic, which is here at CTIR on Air. We are not only proactive responders or reactive responders, we are also proactive consultants. And we do a number of things within our service line in order to protect you from things like ransomware and to make you better responders. And one of our most popular services and is going to be CyberRange. And as Brett said earlier, he is one of our main developers for this service. He is one of our favorite teachers, knows very knowledgeable. So Brett, walk us through what is CyberRange and why should we do it?
Well, have you ever wished that you could send up to 10 of your cybersecurity people to attend a workshop about DFIR, digital forensics, and incident response? better preparing them versus just waiting for something to happen. I know a lot of things like SANS, it's great, but it's like one person at a time. 10 of them, they can work together. So I'm here today to talk about what we do. We not only have one cyber range, we have two. And our first one focuses on network forensics. The second one is host-based. So the big thing is that the host one that we recently developed this past winter into the spring, this one is working with dead box forensics. So we have a triage capture, memory collection, and students get a whole bunch of evidence files, and they are given a number of directions on how to work with it. And at the end, they get it's a 3-day workshop. So the first 2 days are instruction, where instructors work through how to go through memory forensics, Windows event logs, the Windows registry, group policy objects, a bit of Linux forensics, and we touch on the MITRE framework. But the big part is, even though we do use a substantial amount of open source tools, we try to not teach the tools, because end of the day, there's a million things out there. There's so many ways to approach something, and it's good to have multiple, more than just one. If you rely on one tool and something goes wrong, you're high and dry. So we do use a lot of open source options like Volatility for memory analysis, but we try to focus on the methodology behind pulling that thread and just thinking through the problem, building out a timeline. And once students get those first 2 days, the third day is a capstone where they're, the FBI gave you an IP. Good luck. Yeah, you don't get any other information. And so students have to work together with an elected incident commander. So someone gets that hands-on experience of kind of herding the cats and getting a good amount of direction for that team building going on. So as a result, different people are divvied up tasks, and when they finish, they have to give these different status updates throughout the day. So, one right after lunch, one in the afternoon, and then one near the end of the day. And that is where we bring in the instructors, and they act as a executive leadership. And so the incident commander has to deal with kind of that pressure of, you need to get things together, build that timeline, and be able to get status updates. So it's better than the tabletop, because you not only are trying to deal with escalation tree, the basics and wrangling things and analyzing, but you're actually doing it directly. And you might be in a completely different environment than you're used to. So everyone is kind of at space at the square one, working together and trying to overcome the issue. So students dive into the MFT. There's a lot of other nice options that they can learn. We use things like Eric Zimmerman tools, Cyber Chef, Elk Stack for Kibana hunting, Volatility, quite a bit of stuff. And at the end, we have about two instructors or so. So we have a nice 5 students to 1 instructor ratio. So 10 students, 2 instructors. And at the very end, we have a 24 CPE credits that we award for the completion of the cyber range for each student that does continue all 3 days. And they can take those 24 CPEs and apply them towards the renewal of whatever cybersecurity certificates of their desire. And we try to make it so that they can walk away and at least have had an opportunity to dive into some of the different tools and methods that they may not do on their everyday basis. The general type that attend, we say that if you work in a security operations center, or if you do digital forensics already, this is perfect for you. But you might be a network administrator or a system administrator, maybe a CISO, and maybe a manager of some sort. This is still good as long as command line is near something that's completely okay with, and you don't mind staring at logs and having to sit there for several hours straight dealing with something. If you generally take a SANS training, then this is right up your alley. So that covers it for CyberRange.
Thank you. That is such great information. And like Brett said, it's a 3-day training. It is phenomenal. We always have rave reviews about it, and it would really get your defenders some really fantastic training. So as always, you know, you can find links available. I believe we've got them running across the screen somewhere. But if not, talosintelligence.com was a pretty much great place to go to where all your sources for this conversation. All right. So I think we're going to move into some questions from our audience, viewers, listeners, whatever they are. And first off, Brett, I just want to, wanted some clarification on something from earlier. What does VDI stand for?
So it's a virtual desktop that you're given just to log into. It's not a full-fledged bare metal system. It's a temporary environment. It may persist if you have a shared volume, maybe a map network drive, but generally it's something that you just log into from anywhere on the internet. You have a centralized hosting infrastructure, and when you're done, it shuts down and your virtual environment is gone.
Well, that was a great definition. All right. So, Nate, for you, have we seen an increase or a decrease in lateral movement after an initial exploitation?
Sure. So that's a tough one for us to answer as CPAR, because we generally most of the time only get the call when things have gotten bad enough that there's lateral movement. Most organizations that have a single host infection and contain it in place would rightly conclude that their SOC has done their job and not, you know, call us to do follow-on action. So usually we get called for to firefight the really bad ones. That said, I have seen an uptick recently in instance where we're getting called to you, where a single server is compromised, then the adversary can't pivot off of it. So I would say compared to 2021, I have actually seen a decrease in adversary successful lateral movement.
What did someone put in place to keep them from pivoting off of that server?
Honestly, I think it's just tools getting better progressively. I'm seeing customers put more or have more awareness that yes, you do need endpoint protection, and not just AV, but EDR, antivirus versus endpoint detection and response on servers, not just workstations. So that would be the number one attribution I would call out for that.
And that is true. I definitely have seen more it's more organizations that we go into finally do have EDR actually on all of their endpoints and not just their workstations and laptops. So great, great, great. That's a good progress. All right. So I think we got a question for, let's let Bruce answer this one. And let's see, how can you leverage the knowledge of attacker TTPs to create actual tangible protections and security solutions?
Oh, that was a long question. You know, it's funny. There's a lot of groups that kind of try to maintain this air of we are super smart and sophisticated and you'll never be able to figure us out and profile what we do. But what it really boils down to, and we've run into several things on this, if we take a lot of the TTPs that we observe in the different engagements that we go through and we build these profiles out to understand how the threat actors operate, the various command lines they use, the tools they use, and a lot of the other things that just kind of are the same across many of our engagements, you know, we can identify the activity that happens right before the large exploitations or the large ransomware drops. And we've done it several times now in incidents where, first of all, you have to have really good reporting and logging systems in place to let you know when something's out of the ordinary, right? And we've had a few companies that have called us and they go, hey, we're kind of seeing some weird activity. Can you take a look at it? And we'll take a peek and we'll go. And on a couple of occasions now, we've gone, yeah, this is all really like alongside. This is matching a lot of stuff that we've seen these threat actor groups do. They've done this, this, this. What's next? Well, next they do this. They move here. They take over your VDI. They exfil data. Then they drop ransomware. And sure enough, you know, they started going through these things, but we caught them before they were able to do things like deploy the ransomware or exfil the data, because we saw it all happening. So my biggest recommendation is to actually research for your vertical and your revenue like area, right? what are the main things that are attacking you? If it's ransomware, look at the ways that ransomware is being delivered through phishing. Make sure you've got things like MFA. Make sure you understand where your business critical applications and storage are, and make sure that your protections for your network are on those things, right? If you don't have large protections form, at least get some form of logging so that you can tell when people are accessing it that potentially shouldn't be accessing it. Nate mentioned earlier about least privilege, right? When you see people hammering access trying to get things, or when you see admin accounts that don't usually access things like that try to access it, take note of those things and then go through and see if it matches any of the TTPs that are largely publicly published out there. Talos has a lot of blogs on threat actor groups and just malware families in general that go through and kind of show you how these guys operate. And it's, as we said earlier, it's largely the same. They largely do a lot of the same things. So it's rough, and it can be hard to kind of wrap your head around your entire system when you start thinking about it. But take note of the TTPs that are out there, and then just start from the basics, build from the ground up. That's where we see a lot of failures in these incidents, is the basic things that people should have but just don't, like good logging, like least privilege, and things like that that the threat actors are able to take advantage of. And build your playbooks from there, right? If you don't have a playbook, write a playbook. If you don't know how to write a playbook, I'm sure CTIR can do that. Yeah. There are lots of things that you can do. And it's people think it's this huge, nebulous, complicated thing. And it doesn't need to be. You can start from the beginning and with help, build yourself up and be able to identify these TTPs and then build a structure around it to handle it.
Yeah, I think, you know, not boiling the ocean is, I think, a key thing. And really, you know, and I think we've been saying this, we're all focused on those basics, right? Like, and then you can start moving into the what happens if aliens comes down and like find ransomware and then get into the system. You know, like the anomalies will come later. Cover your basics first. That's where you're more likely to be attacked anyways. Then you can go move into the more mature, advanced things. Oh, cool. All right. So let's do one more question and then we'll wrap it up. All right, Nate, I think we'll give this one to you. What can we do to protect against man-in-the-browser attacks that manage to bypass MFA by copying session authentication and cookies?
You know, that's a really good and very relevant question, because Microsoft just released a kind of bombshell post about this last month, talking about what happened. So they dubbed it adversary in the middle attack stealing session cookies. So I'll shape my answer specifically around what we've been seeing related to attacks on O365 using that tactic. That's the big one out there in the wild right now. And for those of you that haven't been following it closely, what the adversary will actually do is they'll send phishing emails or whatnot that link to what appears to be your Microsoft login page, but is actually a adversary controlled website. What they do is they take those credentials and they proxy them over to the legitimate Microsoft site. Then they proxy back the request for multi-factor authentication, which the user, of course, this being a credible attack, accepts. And then at that point, the adversary site gains a legitimate session cookie. And from the O365 authentication system's perspective, the adversary is now authenticated and can do what they want. So the answer to that, what we can do, and this is coming straight from Microsoft's guidance, by the way, is conditional access policies. You can set up your O365 or other Microsoft product systems to impose certain restrictions on where and when and other things you can authenticate. So I'll use this example because we actually did see an attacker come from Nigeria.
Was it a prince?
Very possibly. Most of the fishers from Nigeria are princes, I hear.
Such royalty.
Exactly. So what it would do on the O365 authentication side, you know, Azure AD or whatever you use, it would show the authentication request coming from Nigeria. So if you're an organization that has users primarily based, let's say, in Southeast US, you might set the conditional access policy to only accept connections that are geographically from the US. Now, an adversary can still use other infrastructures, so it's not perfect. But through a series of thoughtful rules like that, you can help limit that damage. And then, of course, the other thing Microsoft says is just monitor consistently. In all the cases we see, we do see a break in pattern. A user will use a specific set of IPs, and then invariably when we see the adversary jump in, it'll be a shift. So I had one customer that actually made a very creative rule. They measured the distance between the geolocation of IP addresses, assuming the user wasn't using VPN, and then they calculated the speed the user would have to travel from one IP location to the next between authentications. And if it exceeded the speed of an airplane, it would get flagged for review. So very fascinating. I thought it was incredibly creative, and it's something you can think about.
I mean, is it like Delta's airplane? Like, is it actually going to make it there at some point, or is it just going to be delayed?
Yeah, got to put in some generous allowances for delays these days.
So from an analyst perspective, what were the type of logs? Like, what did you need to do for your end before, you know, we had the obvious answers? Like, what were the logs that an organization would need to have in order for you to figure out that this is what happened?
So they really need to go to their O365 audit logs, specifically the authentication logs. That gives you user agent strings, IP addresses, times, just a wealth of useful information. That's what we use to narrow down, I'd say, 95% of our business email compromise cases.
Is that something that Microsoft gives you by default, or do you have to do some steps on your side to make sure that you're collecting those?
I would check into it. There are different levels of licensing. E3 and E5 are the ones we deal with the most. Obviously, the best you can afford is good, but in most cases, you'll have at least something to work with. Conditional access policies, though, that's something you need to set up on your own. There's no defaults that'll help you in this case, as far as I'm aware.
Yep. So a little legwork, but it'll save you some hassle in the end. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap this up. Thanks, everybody, for joining. Again, if you want more information on Talos, please go to talosintelligence.com. If you are experiencing an incident, you can contact us immediately. We are a global 24 hours every day of the year service. We don't get to sleep. So you can call us at 1-844-831-7715. Wow, I feel very much like a talk radio show host. So call us now, 1-844-831-7715. Or you can also email us at, what is our email address? I believe it is, it is incidentresponse@cisco.com. I know our email address, I swear. incidentresponse@cisco.com, and that will come straight to us. All right. With that, thank you everybody for joining, and I guess CTIR on air is off.